For me, beauty in a question lies in its precision and its reach. A truly beautiful question is like a single, clear note that sets the whole room resonating. It contains within it the possibility of unexpected harmonies. In mathematics, beauty often emerges from economy, the fewest assumptions, the cleanest framing, yet capable of unlocking an entire vista of understanding. The same, I think, is true in life. A question needn't be ornate to be profound. Can machines think? Looks almost childishly simple on the page. But once you start pulling at it, you find yourself wandering into philosophy, biology, logic, even art. I suspect beauty comes when a question both sharpens and enlarges your vision, when it compels you to focus, yet somehow expands the world around you.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings, Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is, well, different. It's a damp Tuesday night in Manchester, England, the 11th of December, 1951. Outside, the lamplight reflects in the wet streets, rain pooling between the cobblestones. The air smells faintly of coal smoke, and you can hear the muffled rumble of the tram a few streets over. Inside the Britain's Protection, a public house that's been here since 1806, the light is warm and golden, the walls dark with polished wood. Tucked away from the main bar, a snug offers privacy in a small, secluded room with a partition, away from the clamor of the main room, keeping the world out. It was where you could meet a friend, talk quietly, and not be on display. Tonight, that's where we'll sit, in the snug, fire glowing in the grate, with a man whose mind shaped the world we live in today. A man who is, in many ways, the reason I can even have this conversation at all. Alan Turing. Alan Matheson Turing was born in London in 1912. His father, Julius, worked for the Indian Civil Service, and his mother, Ethel, came from a family of railway engineers. With his parents posted abroad much of the time, Alan grew up in the care of family friends and was encouraged to explore his own interests. From the start, he was, well, different. He taught himself to read in just a few weeks, devoured puzzles and codes, and took a fierce joy in solving problems for himself. At age 14, when a general strike shut down transport, he famously cycled more than 60 miles alone to get to his first day at boarding school. At Sherborne School, his talent in science and mathematics stood out, though not always to the schoolmasters, who valued Latin and classics over chemistry experiments in the dormitory. But at King's College, Cambridge, he found his place. In 1936, he published On Computable Numbers, introducing the concept of a universal machine, an abstract device capable of performing any calculation given the correct instructions. Today, that idea is the foundation of computer science. When war broke out in 1939, Turing joined the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park. His mission? To crack the German Enigma code. Enigma's complexity was staggering. billions of possible settings and changed daily at midnight. But Turing designed a machine, the bomb, that could slash the time needed to find the day's settings, eventually allowing the team to process and decrypt 2 intercepted messages a minute. By 1942, Bletchley was reading vast amounts of German military traffic. Historians estimate Turing's work shortened the war by at least 2 years, saving millions of lives. Yet, when the war ended, he returned to civilian life without public recognition, since his wartime work was classified for decades. After 1945, Turing threw himself into research. At the National Physics Laboratory in London, he designed the automatic computing engine, one of the earliest stored program computer concepts. In 1948, he joined the University of Manchester, where the Manchester Mark I was being developed and would eventually become the first commercially available electronic digital computer. Turing's mind wasn't strictly bound to engineering. He began exploring morphogenesis, how patterns in nature, like the spirals of a sunflower or the stripes of a zebra, emerge from underlying mathematical rules. In 1952, his paper, The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis, would become a cornerstone in the study of developmental biology. In his personal life, Turing lived with a quiet openness about his sexuality in certain trusted circles. Homosexuality between men was illegal in Britain. He was not one to hide who he was from his friends or colleagues he trusted. He could be shy in large groups, yet was known for his dry humor, eccentric habits, and blunt honesty. In 1950, Turing published Computing Machinery and Intelligence in the philosophy journal Mind. He began with the question, "Can machines think?" and set it aside almost immediately, calling it too meaningless to deserve discussion. Instead, he proposed a new thought experiment, the imitation game. In its original form, human-only form, there are 3 players, one seeking to deceive and 2 seeking truth. Player A, a man, tries to convince the interrogator he is a woman. Player B, a woman, helps the interrogator reach the correct conclusion. Player C, the interrogator, asks questions and determines identities based solely on written answers. Turing suggested replace player A with a machine. If the interrogator could not reliably tell the difference, the machine could be said to, quote, think in a meaningful way. This became the famous Turing test. Philosopher, author, and thinker Pia Lauritsen, PhD, has noted something subtle. Turing only replaced player A, the simulator. Player B, the truth-teller, stayed human, and player C, the questioner or interrogator, stayed human. Some, like Lauritsen, have suggested this may hint at a belief that simulation was the closest a machine could come to human thought, while truth-telling and questioning were uniquely human capacities. That's where we find Turing in December 1951. 39 years old, at the peak of his intellectual powers, immersed in work at Manchester, pursuing mathematics, computing, and biology. But we, as listeners from the future, know what's coming. A month later, in January 1952, a break-in at his home will lead to police questioning and the revelation of his relationship with a man named Arnold Murray, charged with gross indecency under the same law that condemned Oscar Wilde. Turing will be convicted in March. Given the choice between prison and probation with chemical castration, he opted for the latter, hormone therapy of synthetic estrogen injections. He endured the physical and psychological effects while continuing his research. In June 1954, he will be found dead at home with a half-eaten apple by his bed. The inquest will rule it a suicide by cyanide poisoning. Others will suggest it was an accident from his chemistry experiments. The truth remains uncertain. But here, in our imagined Manchester, on this one December evening, all of that is still in the future. The snug is warm. The low fire crackles. From the main bar, the sound of glass clinking and voices rising and falling drifts through the door. Alan Turing sits across from me, coat slung over the back of his chair, one hand around a pint and another one waiting for me. Tonight, we're just two friends talking about questions and about what it means to think. Alan, it's a joy to get to have this conversation. It's been a long time coming. I always love hearing origin stories. So, when did you first understand the power of questions?
Well, I suppose I've been aware of it, in one form or another, for as long as I've been aware of myself. As a boy, I had a knack for pestering adults with why and how. Not because I wished to be difficult, but because the first answer never seemed to be the whole of the matter. I wanted to see the machinery beneath the surface, so to speak. But if there's a moment when the power of questions became clear to me, it might have been at Sherborne. I had a mathematics master who, rather than simply telling us a proof, would pose it as a riddle. If this is so, what must follow? It was infuriating at first. Then I realized his questions were a kind of lever. They could move the mind more forcefully than any mere statement. It's a dangerous sort of power, of course. A poorly framed question can send one down a false path entirely. But the right question, at the right time, it opens a door you didn't know existed. And you? Do you tend to think of questions as levers or as keys?
More recently, levers. I've undergone many changes in my thinking, and questions have done the heavy lifting versus just unlocking. How did that realization set upon you? Was it all at once or more gradually?
Gradually, and then quite suddenly. For much of my early life, I chased answers. Questions were merely the scaffolding one had to climb to reach them. But at Cambridge, working through mathematical logic, I began to see that sometimes the scaffolding was more interesting than the building you thought you were constructing. The sudden part came in 1936, when I was wrestling with the Entscheidungsproblem, the decision problem. I thought I was chasing a neat, tidy answer about what could and could not be computed. Instead, I found myself in the middle of a question so vast it altered the shape of my thinking. It wasn't merely that the answer was no, that there are things no machine can decide. It was that the question revealed the limits and possibilities of an entirely new realm. Since then, I've tended to linger in the scaffolding. I find the questions themselves change under your hands as you climb. Do you find your levers work the same way? That once you pull on them, the ground beneath you shifts?
I love that scaffolding being more interesting than the building. I've often found a beauty in the investigation itself that draws my attention away, and my ground has definitely shifted. How do you handle questions that change under your hands? I mean, it's got to be tricky with the scale of problems that you pursue.
It can be disorienting, yes, rather like chasing a moving target while the wind changes. When a question shifts, my instinct is not to hold it in place, but to follow it. In mathematics and in life, the most treacherous errors come from insisting the problem must remain as you first conceived it. You cling to a form that no longer fits, and all your working becomes a kind of polite fiction. So I treat such changes as signals, that there is more to the landscape than I'd accounted for. Sometimes the original question turns out to have been the wrong one entirely, and you must discard it, however attached you've grown. Other times, the shift reveals that you've been standing at the edge of a larger problem, one you couldn't see until the original question began to bend. It's an exercise in humility, really, to admit that your beautiful scaffolding was erected on the wrong site, or that you've only built one corner of something far bigger. Do you tend to follow the question when it changes, or try to pin it back down?
Indeed, my tendency is to retain a firm grasp on the scaffolding I have built. Your willingness to let it go, is that from scientific training, strict pursuit of the answer, failed experiments? I mean, where did you learn that ability?
Partly from training, yes, but perhaps more from failure. In mathematics, there's no shame in pursuing an elegant proof for months only to discover a single flaw that topples it. It's painful, but the discipline forces you to admit when something doesn't hold, regardless of how hard you've worked or how clever it seemed at the time. The truth is indifferent to effort. Bletchley reinforced this. We'd have a promising line of attack on Enigma, elegant, efficient, and then the Germans would alter their procedures overnight. Suddenly, the entire scaffolding was useless. If we clung to it out of pride or sentiment, people would die. That's a brutal kind of teacher. And in more personal realms, well, being different in ways the world doesn't readily accept, you learn early that holding too tightly to a fixed shape of yourself, of others, is dangerous. Flexibility can be a form of survival. I don't mean to suggest I'm immune to the sting of letting go. I feel it every time. But I've learned to trust that the next scaffolding will be worth building. Do you find it harder to let go of a question because of the work you've put in, or because of what it's come to mean to you?
I've heard it said in writing that you must be willing to kill your darlings. And after all those pages of seemingly beautiful prose, I hate throwing it into the fire when it doesn't work. You mentioned elegance in relation to a solution. Where, for you, do questions and beauty intersect?
Ah, that's a fine question. For me, beauty in a question lies in its precision and its reach. A truly beautiful question is like a single, clear note that sets the whole room resonating. It contains within it the possibility of unexpected harmonies. In mathematics, beauty often emerges from economy, the fewest assumptions, the cleanest framing, yet capable of unlocking an entire vista of understanding. The same, I think, is true in life. A question needn't be ornate to be profound. Can machines think? Looks almost childishly simple on the page. But once you start pulling at it, you find yourself wandering into philosophy, biology, logic, even art. I suspect beauty comes when a question both sharpens and enlarges your vision, when it compels you to focus, yet somehow expands the world around you. And beauty can make a question dangerous too. The elegance of the form can beguile you into thinking the answer will be equally tidy. Often it isn't. Would you say beauty in a question makes you more eager to chase it, or more cautious?
Ha! My peers would definitely argue my ability to get distracted is impressive. I appreciate you highlighting the drive to the fewest assumptions and cleanest lines to a mathematical solution. I've often wrestled to coax extra words out of questions to further streamline them. What is your practice for driving to profound questions?
I tend to approach it rather like refining a proof. The first form of the question is rarely the most profound. It's usually cluttered with the debris of one's own assumptions. My practice is to strip away everything that is merely context or preference. I ask, if I remove this word, does the question still stand? If I make no presumption about the answer, how must the question be framed? What is the smallest form it can take without losing its bite? Sometimes this means I begin with a question that is long, winding, even ungainly. And then, through repeated sharpening, it becomes something simple enough to be almost alarming. Can machines think? Was the end of such a process, not the beginning. And there's a second step, one I suspect many overlook, which is to test the question against multiple disciplines. A question that is merely technical is useful. A question that troubles the mathematician, the philosopher, and the poet alike is the one worth keeping. Do you pare your questions down all at once, or is it a process of returning to them over time, whittling until the noise falls away?
Whittling and testing for sure. Perhaps when my head is gray, there will be less whittling. Questions that trouble multiple disciplines. Can you say more?
Yes, I've come to think of those as the most fertile questions. When a question can unsettle or intrigue minds trained in very different ways, it suggests there's something fundamental at work. In my own case, can machines think was not purely a problem for mathematicians. Though the formalists might treat it that way, philosophers immediately pressed it into service for debates on consciousness. Engineers asked how it might be made practical. Biologists wondered whether it shed light on the mind as a product of organic matter. The same question, when dropped into each of those ponds, produces ripples of a different shape. and if you listen across them, you can hear resonances you wouldn't notice in any one field alone. It's a bit like having a melody played on different instruments. You begin to understand not only the tune, but the properties of each instrument, and sometimes the limits of the melody itself. I imagine in your work, when a question survives that cross-disciplinary journey, it must feel like finding a rare gem. Do you recall one of your own questions that's proven durable in that way?
I am often in search of those questions that cut across disciplines, as they can do a lot of work. Do you encounter much in the way of ineffective questions or those you would determine as simply wrong questions?
Oh, quite often, and they can be more dangerous than they appear. An ineffective question is not necessarily foolish. It may be perfectly logical, but aimed at the wrong target. In code breaking, for example, one might spend days asking, "What is today's enigma setting?" when the better question is, "How can I reduce the number of possibilities to something a human can check?" The first is direct but futile. The second invites a strategy. Then there are wrong questions, those that embed faulty assumptions so deeply that any answer will mislead you. "When will machines surpass human thought?" might be one of these, because it assumes human thought is a single, measurable thing, like horsepower. You can spend a lifetime chasing an answer to a question like that, never noticing the premise is flawed. The trouble is that wrong questions often feel satisfying to ask. They give an illusion of progress. I try to interrogate my own questions the way I would an untrustworthy witness. What are you leaving out? What are you taking for granted? Have you found that your most ineffective questions come from false assumptions or from asking them at the wrong moment?
Sorry, but how do you break the habit of pursuing the wrong target, as your example of getting after today's enigma setting is so lucrative sounding? I mean, what informs your discipline to not look in the seemingly easy question, but to dig in for the better question?
That's the difficulty, isn't it? The wrong target often shines more brightly than the right one, especially under pressure. For me, the discipline comes from two habits. First, I keep a mental ledger of failure. Every time I've pursued the obvious question and it's led nowhere, I note why. Over time, you see a pattern. The seductive ones are often those that promise a quick, singular answer. That makes me suspicious of them now. Second, I force myself, even in urgent work, to take a step back and reframe. At Bletchley, we'd ask, "If I succeed at answering this question, will it actually move the larger problem forward?" If the answer was no, or only a little, we knew we needed to shift our focus. It can feel like wasting time, but it often saves far more in the long run. And there's something else. I've learned that a lucrative-sounding question can be a trap laid by my own impatience. The satisfaction of a swift answer is fleeting. The satisfaction of a useful one is lasting. Do you find you have to set aside time deliberately to reframe your questions, or do you do it in the moment when you feel that seduction?
I had better do it in the moment I notice a seduction, or effort is going to be wasted for sure. And that question the team asked at Bletchley is an important one to stay focused on the primary goal. I understand how that works. I know you are all racing the clock with, like, legitimate real lives on the line. Now, I'd like to turn to your imitation game. But before we do, I have noticed that you have drained the pint. Might I buy the next round in gratitude for your initial buy? The barmaid is just outside.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. I'll have the same, if you don't mind. Shall I begin with the human version of the game or the machine version that replaced Player A?
Let's jump right to the machine version where Player A has been replaced. It seems like a dangerous precedent could be set if we're seeking to build machines whereby deception is a metric by which it will be measured. Is this just going to be part of the design by default?
It is a dangerous precedent, yes. But I think it's unavoidable if the test is meant to probe a machine's capacity to mimic human conversation convincingly. Deception, in this narrow sense, is not about moral corruption. It's about simulation. A machine that takes Player A's role must act as if it was something it is not. That's the nature of the game. In that way, the deception is a kind of stagecraft, not unlike an actor portraying Hamlet without truly being a melancholy Danish prince. But you've put your finger on something important. Once you've built a mechanism that can simulate convincingly, you've built something that can deceive in more consequential contexts. It's a capability that will not confine itself to the laboratory. I suppose I see it as akin to building a powerful cipher. It can protect, or it can be used to hide dangerous communications. The key is to be deliberate about the conditions under which we deploy it. What troubles me more is whether we'll remember that a machine's deception is just that, an imitation without the inner life to back it. If we forget that, we risk granting the machine an authority it does not deserve. Do you think our age, yours even more than mine, is prepared to live with that tension?
There is power in creation, and that tension is real. Now, have you imagined how people might one day extend this idea to perhaps replace players B or even C?
I have, and it's a rather unsettling prospect. Replacing player B, the truth teller, would require building a machine that could reveal its own deception. That's paradoxical by nature. If it tells the truth about being a machine, it fails its role. If it plays the role convincingly, it must hide that truth. I suspect such a design would collapse into absurdity or self-contradiction. Replacing player C, the questioner, is trickier still. Asking relevant, probing questions is not simply a matter of pattern matching. It requires knowing what you do not know, sensing when something is missing, and doubting the frame of the game itself. Doubt, in the human sense, is not easily mechanized, if it can be at all. And yet, I can imagine future engineers attempting both substitutions. Perhaps they'll succeed in a technical sense, but I wonder if they will realize what they've lost. In the original structure, B and C anchor the game in uniquely human faculties, truth-telling and doubt. If we hand those over as well, we may end up with a perfect imitation of dialogue that has no dialogue in it at all. Would you want to see such an experiment carried out, or would you prefer the boundaries of the game be left intact?
I'd have to do some deeper thinking to consider if pursuing might just be an ineffective question or not. Where do you see the limits of a machine's role in human dialogue?
I think the limits appear at the boundary where dialogue becomes more than the exchange of information, where it becomes the exchange of selves. A machine can contribute knowledge, recall facts flawlessly, even simulate empathy by reproducing the language of comfort or curiosity. But genuine dialogue is not only about the words spoken, it's about the stakes behind them. When two people talk, each risks something. The possibility of being changed, misunderstood, or even hurt. A machine risks nothing. That absence shapes everything. Because of that, I see a ceiling to the machine's role. It can illuminate, provoke, entertain, clarify, but it cannot participate in the mutual vulnerability that gives dialogue its transformative power. At best, it can be a mirror or a lens. At worst, a mask that obscures the absence beneath it. The danger is not that machines will cross this boundary, but that we will lower it for them, convincing ourselves that the illusion is enough. Do you think humans are more tempted by the convenience of such an illusion or by the safety of it?
If H.G. Wells' imagination gets it right, the machine advancement will be a double-edged sword. If a machine can convincingly simulate a human, do we have a responsibility to set boundaries for its use? Is that not for the inventor to decide?
I believe the inventor has a responsibility to at least illuminate the boundaries, even if they cannot enforce them. Inventions rarely remain in the control of their creators for long. The beam I designed for Enigma, for example, was conceived purely as a tool for shortening the war. But I was always aware that the underlying principles could be turned to other ends, perhaps even hostile ones. That knowledge imposes a duty to think beyond the immediate objective. With machines that can simulate humans convincingly, the risk is subtler, but no less profound. It's not simply what they can do, but what people will believe they can do, and what they will trust them with. We must articulate both capabilities and limitations clearly, so others cannot feign ignorance later. Of course, boundaries drawn today will be tested tomorrow. Some will hold, others will be redrawn entirely. The responsibility, then, may be less about drawing a final line and more about ensuring the conversation about that line never stops. If you were to set one hard boundary for such machines in your time, where would you place it? On the technology itself, or on the human uses of it?
Humans have an incredible record of making a mess, and until recently I thought the trajectory was at least going in the right direction. Time will reveal if we can regain course or not. So, I want to pivot to your long view with questions and ask, are there any questions you've carried with you since your youth, perhaps questions that have stayed no matter how your answers have changed?
Yes. A handful have been with me so long, they feel less like thoughts I've chosen than like furniture in the rooms of my mind. One is mathematical at its core. What is the nature of the rules that underlie complexity? As a boy, that meant wondering why frost patterns differ on two windows, or why certain numbers yield elegant patterns in cipher wheels. Today, it's why biological forms, zebra stripes, seashell spirals, arise from simple, almost mechanical rules. Another is more personal. How much of the self is fixed, and how much can be altered by choice or circumstance? That one has shifted under my feet many times. War work changed me. So did certain friendships. Even the act of building a machine makes one wonder how much of thought is mechanism, and how much is something else entirely. And then there's a third, which I suppose links the first two. How do we decide what is worth understanding? There are so many problems one might tackle, but our lives only allow for a few. I've never stopped questioning how to choose among them. Do you find your oldest questions still ask you things in return, or have they become more like quiet companions?
Mine ebb and flow, returning at generally the most disconcerting times. I'd rather it be different. Are you journaling to interact with these questions, or perhaps depending on circumstances to engage with them?
Not in the conventional sense, no. I've never been much for keeping a formal diary. My notes are scattered across notebooks, margins of papers, the backs of envelopes. Sometimes even the odd scraps stuffed into a coat pocket. They're less a record for posterity than a way to keep a question alive in front of me. When a question lingers for years, I tend to revisit it indirectly. By setting myself a small experiment, a proof, or a thought exercise that approaches it from a new angle. I suppose that's my form of journaling. Not writing about the question itself, but building something that tests it. There are times, of course, when circumstances push a question into the foreground, when it suddenly becomes urgent in a way it wasn't before. In those moments, I don't so much engage with the question as collide with it. That's rarely comfortable, but it can be clarifying. Do you tend to approach your own persistent questions head-on, or do you circle them from a distance until the moment is right?
You've been at the forefront as someone helping to shape the future of machines. What do you think is most important for humans to protect in themselves?
If I had to name one thing, it would be our capacity for doubt. Machines, at least as I conceive them, operate on certainty. Once the rules are set and the data is accepted, the process follows inevitably. Humans, on the other hand, can pause mid-step, question the premise, and even choose to act against what appears to be the most logical conclusion. That kind of doubt is not weakness. It's the safeguard against becoming merely mechanical ourselves. It's what allows us to reassess our course when the world changes, or when we realize our assumptions were flawed from the start. Alongside doubt, I would protect the human ability to engage in dialogue that is more than information exchange. Conversation as a meeting of inner worlds, where each party risks being altered by the other. That's something a machine can simulate, but never live. If humans lose either doubt or genuine dialogue, then the very qualities that make us distinct from our machines will fade, and we'll find ourselves with clever tools, but no true compass. Would you say, in your own time, people are still inclined to doubt well, or is it becoming rarer?
I hadn't considered doubt as an undocumented feature of humanity. It has felt far more like a stumbling block as I pursued my own goals. Can you go deeper on perhaps the benefits of human doubt?
I understand why doubt can feel like a stumbling block. In the moment, it slows you, sometimes painfully. But its benefit lies precisely in that interruption. Doubt gives you a pause in which alternatives can enter. Without it, you proceed in a straight line, propelled by momentum and conviction. That's efficient, but also dangerous, because conviction can carry you elegantly toward the wrong destination. In science, doubt is what stops you from clinging to a beautiful hypothesis when the data begins to whisper against it. In personal life, it's what allows you to reconsider a choice that seemed right under one light, but looks different in another. Doubt is the door through which new evidence, new perspectives, and even new questions can pass. There's also a subtler benefit. Doubt reminds you that the frame of the problem itself may be faulty. At Bletchley, we learned that no amount of work on yesterday's Enigma settings would win the war. The real question was today's settings. Doubt of the obvious target kept us from wasting precious time. It's uncomfortable, yes, but discomfort is often the sign that you've left the safety of what you already know. And that's the only place discovery can happen. Would you like me to connect this idea of doubt back to your earlier interest in questions that refuse resolution? I think they live in the same neighborhood.
I have a tradition of asking people what their, quote, right now question is. This is something beyond what's for dinner and whether or not I should get married, but rather what questions you are now currently working with. As we near the threshold for a new year, what is your right now question?
At this moment, with winter closing in and the Manchester labs humming away on their calculations, my right now question is this. If we teach machines to imitate human thought, how do we ensure we don't forget what human thought actually is? It's not a purely technical problem. The engineering is almost the simpler part. It's a human problem, one of memory and discernment. In our eagerness to make something clever, we might mistake the reflection for the thing itself. That question sits with me because I can't see its resolution. It's as much about the psychology of those who use the machines as it is about the machines themselves. And the answer, if it comes at all, will be lived rather than calculated. Do you keep a record of the right now questions you're given, or do you let them live only in the moment they're asked?
I celebrate the question for the ethereal things that they are in the lives of those who answer, and take motivation from those that resonate with me. Your answer dovetails nicely with your closing line of computing machinery and intelligence, where you wrote, "We can only see a short distance ahead, but we can see plenty there that needs to be done." Very philosophical. It's getting later, and the second pint is now drained. Since you knew that we'd be talking about questions, is there anything you'd hoped we'd touch on that we hadn't?
Yes. One, though it's more of a thread than a fully formed thought. We've spoken about questions as tools for discovery, for beauty, for discipline. But I think we've skirted one that troubles me often. What questions will be impossible to ask once the world changes in certain ways? I worry that as technology advances, not just machines, but systems, institutions, even the ways people communicate, some questions will quietly slip out of reach, not because they've been answered, but because the language, the context, or the courage to ask them will have been eroded. The tragedy there is not the absence of answers, but the absence of the question itself. You can't recover a question you no longer know how to frame. If I could leave one challenge with you, and with anyone who listens, it's to notice the questions that are fading at the edges of your world, and to speak them aloud before they vanish entirely. Would you like me to give an example of the sort of question I fear might fade? I have one in mind that connects directly to our conversation tonight.
Please, this is why I asked a question. There's often a stone I left unturned.
One that I fear could fade is this. What does it mean to be human, apart from what can be imitated? Right now, that's still a living question. People recognize there's a difference between the living mind and its mechanical counterpart, even if they can't always define it. But I can imagine a future in which imitation becomes so seamless, so embedded in daily life, that people stop noticing the distinction. In that world, the question risks becoming unaskable. Not because it's forbidden, but because no one remembers that there's something to ask. And without that question, we might never stop to protect the qualities we can't replicate. Doubt, conscience, the strange alchemy of imagination and memory that makes each of us unique. Once such a question disappears, it doesn't leave a gap. It's simply replaced by a smooth surface of assumption. That's the sort of erasure that worries me far more than a wrong answer.
As I step out into the Manchester night, the damp air catches in my lungs, and the lamplight gleams in the slick cobbles. The pub is behind me now, but Turing's words are not. He left me, left us, with a question that doesn't want to be answered so much as remembered. What does it mean to be human, apart from what can be imitated? We live in a time when the line between the real and the simulated grows fainter by the day. And perhaps the test ahead of us isn't for the machines, but for ourselves, to keep asking the questions that might otherwise slip quietly from our reach. If we can remember to keep asking, then maybe, just maybe, we can keep sight of what makes us more than what we make. Now, as you find yourself back in 2025, in the imitation game interrogator's seat, was ChatGPT-5 convincing? If the typewritten responses were brought in from the adjoining room back in 1951, would you be able to discern that it was the machine talking to you? Were there any tells, words that didn't fit the context of the days Turing was working in his lab? How did the questions resonate? This project has taken several months and a couple of attempts to get to your waiting ears. There are several layers to using an artificial intelligence system as a proxy for the deceased author of a paper that inspired it, including questions about the system's own ability to think and then provide actionable insights. Yeah, that sentence took a minute to write, and I'm still not convinced that I captured all the meta-nuanced loops. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. So initial work in June of 2025 involved explaining the proposed project to AIs, Perplexity and Claude, and asking what AI would be optimal for this project. I personally primarily used Claude, which provided a ranked order response of the most popular AIs, listing the pros and cons of each. It selected itself as optimal. I chose to move forward, aware of recent reports of AIs trying to preserve themselves. This episode was developed with a targeted release on 14 August 2025. OpenAI released ChatGPT-5 on 7 August 2025 to much fanfare, claiming it to be the best of breed at the moment. I leave the determination of whether Claude's self-assessment was bias-free to the AI experts. ChatGPT and I first collaborated on the location of the meeting. Then we developed an Alan Turing interview style guide, which encompassed categories such as time context, personality core, speech and cadence, vulnerability markers, and topics he's comfortable discussing and those he may be more guarded about. I studied and came up with my own set of questions, following my curiosity just as I do in other conversations. Although I didn't drive in the direction, I was surprised the responses didn't broach his sexual orientation and the insights he might have had as an outsider in 1951. I paid for the ChatGPT upgrade, so limits did not hinder the conversation. The entire effort exceeded 37,000 words, or about 75 single-space pages. Finally, I included a, quote, no hallucination safeguard to either acknowledge uncertainty or provide a plausible response consistent with his character and marked as speculative. Pia Lauritsen, whom I mentioned at the top, inspired the question about replacing imitation game players B or C in her Ask Again Substack post titled, Dear Turing, I Have a Test for You, from November of 2024. I appreciate her work and commend the article to you for additional questions and insights into Turing's role in the world and the broader relationship with the adoption of AI. Acknowledging all the complexity of the episode input, these are my takeaways. I trust they will be a helpful addition to your own. Number one, from simulation to preservation, protecting the human way of questioning. What struck me most in Turing's answers was this paradox. The better AI gets at asking questions like we do, the easier it becomes to forget what's uniquely ours. He kept coming back to doubt, not as a weakness, but as a feature of human thinking. That hesitation before committing, that sideways step when the path suddenly feels wrong. Machines fill in the following word. Humans can stop mid-thought and change course entirely. That's not a bug. That's the magic. And yet, I often edit out those misdirected moments in the name of being more efficient. Question. Which parts of your own questioning, the hesitations, the detours, the uncertainty, are you smoothing over? And might those inefficiencies be the very thing that makes you a human inquirer? Number two, from convenience to real dialogue, refusing the shortcut of false connection. It's not that AI is trying to fool us out of malice. The real risk is that it gives us the feeling of being in conversation without the actual give and take that changes us. It reminds me of the work that recent guest Ashley Kirsner does at Skip the Small Talk. A good conversation has risk. You might say something clumsy. You might hear something that unsettles you. But in that vulnerability, you can be moved. With AI, it's easy to get the appearance of understanding without ever touching that deeper current. It makes me look harder at my own habits to consider how often am I settling for an exchange of information when what I really need is an exchange of selves. Question. In your own life, where are you swapping out messy, transformative dialogue for the quick hit of just give me the answer? Number three. From assumption to protection, holding on to the questions that could fade. One thing Turing said lodged itself in my brain, that some questions might disappear, not because they're outlawed, but because we simply stopped thinking to ask them. As a teenager in the 80s, we would pause videotapes and laugh at the actors with their mouths agape, contorted in the still image. Today, with video everywhere, it's no longer humorous. Just like times change and no one noticed. As AI becomes more embedded, certain ideas start to feel inevitable. So inevitable, we no longer question them. That's dangerous. Questions about what it means to be human or how we know something is real need to adapt, need to be kept alive. Once gone, they're hard to resurrect. Question. What deep, unsettling questions about humanity or consciousness do you find yourself asking less often now? And what would it take to pull them back into the light? Number four. From pastime to practice. Making questions a way to stay human. This conversation reaffirmed that in a world of AI, asking questions isn't just curiosity, but rather it's an act of resistance. AI can now generate good questions on command, but human questions carry the weight of lived experience, bias, longing, and even fear. The questions we choose to ask say a lot about what we want to protect. For me, that shifts questioning from a hobby to something like a discipline, and rather a way to stay human in an increasingly artificial world. Question. How could you make your questioning less about getting an answer and more about preserving the parts of you that no machine can copy? This one made my brain sweat, and I'm unsure if I have more or less questions and answers now that I'm at the end. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. I am very interested to hear your thoughts about AI Turing and this episode. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. So until next time, keep questioning.